Welcome to Lost in Transformation. This is Ming Labs, podcasting from Singapore, an international innovation center, business hub, and startup supporter. Learn from digital thought leaders and designers about innovation and transformation of businesses in an ever-evolving digital world. Coming up is your host, Sebastian Müller, co-founder and COO of Ming Labs, with our guest for today, Olivier Soubil. Olivier is a strategist who helps companies rethink their product, processes, or organizational model using innovation methodologies. After working in product concepting, technology innovation, and strategy consultancy, he's now leading the employee experience team in a global bank. We hope you enjoy the conversation and look forward to your feedback.
Hi, Olivier. Thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So maybe let's start by talking a bit about your past journey, so we get a bit of an impression of where you come from. What have you been doing in the last few years? What have your different stations been? And then what we're going to talk about quite a lot today, how have you been coming to interested in employee experience?
The interesting thing about it is that employee experience was never a destination. It just happened. When I'm looking at everything that I've been doing, I've started working on product and especially product innovation, where I was creating mobile phone basically from the ground up. Then after that, I just happened to move to technology innovation, where we're looking at how do we breed new technology that we have never seen anywhere in the world for another organization. Then I moved to innovation strategies, where I was doing some consulting to help some organization to rethink their innovation journeys. And then from there, I moved to employee experience, which was very much about how do we bring design thinking to HR. So when I'm looking at all of that, for me, it's all about innovation. And it's all about how do you apply innovation in different parts of the organization, making product, doing new technologies, having the right strategies, as well as doing the right thing for the people.
And innovation is then also always about transformation, isn't it? How do you then also adopt it and bring it either to the people or inside of the organization, right?
Exactly. I think it's about having always the same methodologies that you can adapt to different domains.
So as a designer, I mean, you're really a craftsman, right? So I think you also mentioned quite a lot already to the word product. What is a product mindset to you?
For me, a product mindset is around how do you create something? And having a product mindset is realizing that there is different stages into creating something. You have a very early stage when it's about conceptualizing. It's about understanding needs. It's about understanding people who are going to use your product. Then you go into the product fabrication, which is all around how do you actually make it and industrialize it. And then you have product lifecycle, which is all around, well, let's monitor how people are using our product. Are they doing what we thought they would be doing? Are we going to learn new behavior that we should adapt to? Are we going to evolve our product to new trends and new expectations from people? And a product, I believe, can be hardware, software, or services. It can really be anything. And that's why I really like the idea of talking about product in every way in the organization. And that's why I think HR can look at providing product to employees, and bringing a product mindset to that process automatically moves away from a very hard view of a captive audience towards what can we do to create something that people will be ready to pay for. And I think that's the holy grail of making really good product.
Right. As you already emphasized, also there's the life cycle, right? There's the product is not a static point in time after you've created it and then there it is, but it has to keep on evolving. You have to keep on investing. Do you feel that within today's organizations, the ones that you have seen, that the business stakeholders really already have that mindset and understand that?
So I don't think so. And I think that's a really big difference between making a product and making a project. A project have a beginning and an end, and a product have an end that is a lot longer,
right?
That you need to manage. And it means you need to be organized differently. You need to know that some people are going to carry that product full-time even after you launch it. And that's a really big part of the value, because the moment where you launch it, usually your product is never that good. You really get value as you maintain it, as you continue with it. I think the problem for a lot of organizations is they tend to run a project, have an output from it, and then give it to a person to maintain it. And that person usually have 5, 10, 20 of those to manage. And you can't have a product mindset when you have 20 of them.
Right.
You need almost the opposite. You need to have maybe a few people that are maintaining one product, because there is so much to do. There is so much to explore, so much to listen to users, so much to think about how to adapt to it. And that's a really big gap that most industries don't have. They tend to believe that after a project, the output can be managed by a percentage of a person, while I really think that you need to have people dedicated to it.
Yeah. So that then also means that the more products you create, essentially the more people you're going to then also need in order to maintain it. Not only the first force of creation, but then actually, I guess, also sprint teams or agile teams that are responsible for actually building it out in the future. So this organization that looks after the product kind of grows and grows and grows if you add more products to it, right?
Exactly. And that's opening a few questions, right? So first of all, you need to realize that you need those resources. You need to realize that being product-driven means you need to reorganize yourself. And you cannot be organized functionally like you might have been before. And you need to look at more and more organizations says that they expect everything provided to their employees, to their users, to be employee-centric, customer-centric, to be consumer-grade. But when you look at a product company, they have an army of product manager that is going to maintain that.
Right.
And again, it's a product organization. So the big question is, are we ready for that? Are we ready to do that? And then open the question around, should we build in-house or should we purchase outside? And that's another big decision, because building in-house means that you can adapt exactly to what you want to, but you need to realize that you, in a way, compete with other organizations that are set up from a product perspective to have all the people, all the research, all the process that you need to make really great product, and you basically compete against them.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to staff it properly, you're probably better off to purchase it and to trust that you purchase the right one instead of trying to make it yourself or adapt it.
So do you maybe have any rough mental framework or rule of thumb of how to think about when should I do something myself and when is it actually better to just purchase something from the outside?
I think the bottom line is, how different do you believe that you are on a particular topic and how important do you think it is for your business?
Yeah.
That's it.
And then if it's fairly table stakes, I just need to be best in class, but I don't need to differentiate, maybe just look at what's out there already. But if it's really a differentiator for the organization, then throw resources behind that.
Exactly. So if you think that the way you measure employee performance is really a core set of who you are as an organization, and that you really think it's differentiating you from all of your other competitors, and that the way that you want to do it is so groundbreaking that nobody else have ever done it that way, then it probably makes sense that you build it yourself.
Yeah. So then in the context of employee experience, what are products, for example?
I think everything can be a product. So you have to look at how do you empower people to do their best work? And as an organization, you have to look at what are the journeys that you think are important for you people to do their best work. And different organizations will have different perspective on that. But in terms of a product, I would say, take your journey, start slicing and dicing it in ways that make sense, and then start looking at, out of those, which ones do you want to productize? But practically, it can be anything. It can be the way people get to the office. It can be the way you measure people. It can be the way people manage their career. It can be the way people collaborate and communicate with each other. So it's not necessarily HR.
Yeah.
It's usually a mix of HR is going to have a big part of it because it's all about human resources, but technology, property, anything else that is about helping people to do something in the organization and to empower them should have a role to play there. And then the question is going to be, how are you going to map that? It's going to be around, you might have different teams that are working on it disconnected. So it's around, how do you make sure that you build almost a community of those teams so that they know what it is that they need to work on. They know what it is that others are working on and where it is that they should collaborate. Sometimes you just need to know that someone else is working on something.
Yep.
Having shuttle buses to take you to the office, not everyone needs to be involved in that. Maybe you can. Technology can be involved if you want Wi-Fi in it, but not necessarily. But knowing that it exists is really important. And that's why having an end-to-end user journeys and employee journeys, I think, is a really strong asset because it helps you to map and to decide where should who be involved.
So basically, while you are part of definitely owning the experience for the employees, you can never do it alone, right? You have to work with so many different stakeholders who might be affecting it, which today might only look at their silo and think of themselves as one closed loop, which they're really not because it's a complex system. How do you get other stakeholders on board when you say, hey, I identified something here in the employee journey, I need you to change something? Is that a difficult job to convince them?
I would say it depends on organizations. You have organizations that are very open-minded, where people take feedback fairly well, and some where people are a lot more defensive. And I think that's about the mindset of your organization. So some of them will be really good with that, some of them will not. The difficulty here is a question about ownership. Who is owning that end-to-end user journeys? And I'm not sure I have a response to that. And I think that there might not be an owner because, as you said, sometimes things are in your domain and sometimes they are not, but you need to find a way to map it. And maybe we need to think of new system so that you can collaborate around those and you can find a way to map all of that and build the right collaboration so that you know what else is happening and have some working together sometime and sometime not, so that you can build an end-to-end view without necessarily having an owner. Because as soon as you have an owner, then you have some politic issues, you have, you know, all the things that come around.
Yeah. And I guess that's especially then also a problem in a global organization, right? But then also it's different countries, where's the priority, who drives something? If it's centralized, I don't know, all in one location, then we're talking about doing something for America or Europe or Africa. Does that make sense for somebody who is in a central location to think about that? That's probably also quite complex.
Agree. And there's a few things here. There is, as a global organization, most of the time you can define global design and global processes. And then you need to look at how we're exactly going to apply them locally and making sure that it makes sense. And different parts of the organizations are organized differently. So for example, HR tend to be very globalized and centralized, but property tend not to be, because property tends to be organized by a building level and very strong different regulations.
Yeah.
But then you have the other question, which is, well, our users are very different. The type of challenges that you have when you are living in London is really different than when you're living in Nairobi. So how are we going to decide what's actually important? And especially when you start talking about health and wellness, it might mean something very different when you are living in an emerging market versus a mature one. It might mean something very different when living in Asia versus in Europe or versus in the US. So how do you decide what actually is important? It is another big challenge that you have to face.
Yeah. And as you go and map out the overall employee experience, I suppose it's a huge map, the journey from hiring to onboarding to everything that's happening when they're there to offboarding and everything in between. How do you decide where it's actually a good scope to focus on, to run a project or to start looking at the product and maybe change that and improve that? How can you make that distinction? Because you only have very limited time available to look at that huge journey. What are the kind of things that you think about when you say, ah, here's something that we should be looking at now?
So first, I think the big issue when you're mapping that is that, as you say, it's a huge map and it needs to be a scalable map. So really when you're looking at it, an employee journey could be fairly simple. You join the organization, you do your work, you progress, you collaborate and find a way to connect with others, and then you leave the organization. I think the key to it is being able to scale it so that you can have 60, 100 experiences inside it, but you can quickly elevate and look at it from a very high level that is going to be quite vanilla, but still important. And I would say start by that level. Start by really looking at what can you do quickly to be at a really high level and start bringing better experiences at that level. And as it goes, you can go deeper. Because otherwise, you're going to get really pointy into let's redesign that particular experience that is going to be really specific, and you are going to be lost in a sea of things to do.
So basically start at 30,000 feet, yeah. See from a high level what works, what doesn't work, are there any quick fixes? And then as you go along, get more and more granular because you can afford to focus more.
Exactly. And you can prove that it works. And the second part that you need to look at is what are the levels of transformation that you want to have? And I think you can organize everything on basically three levels, small, medium, and big. The small one tend to be quick things that you can do. It's often digitalization of processes. The big ones are when you fundamentally rethink something. So, I don't know, performance, for example, right?
Yeah.
So at a lower level, it can be, hey, let's make sure that we have an easy tool so that people can go in and be measured. At a level three level, it would be, what does performance even mean? Should we or not let line managers give performance, or should we fundamentally change that and totally rethink what it is? Those are really hard to do.
Right.
And I think it's important when you start mapping the activities that you want to do that you start with small things and gradually move to bigger ones. It means you're going to redo some work, and that's a bit of a shame. But starting by big things, again, is difficult. And yeah. I think at the beginning, you need to do a bit of trailblazing before you start building really big roads.
I guess it also pays a little bit into your internal political capital if you have quick wins and if you can show here, we actually did something, and then you can breach the bigger topics exactly. Step by step.
You need to build some credibility. Usually you have owners for those topics that are experts. And we always say the problem that we have is that everything is designed by experts for experts who know really well the state of the art, the complexity that can happen, the regulations. And because of that, they lose track of what people are actually looking for.
Right.
So you also have to take them on a journey. You have to get them to understand that it's important to be employee-centric, to be user-centric, and to understand that point of view. And sometimes it is about not being complete. Sometimes it is about not fully applying all regulation, all cases that could apply. And it's about designing for 80-20. And that way, by taking those people with you, you can quickly teach them, you know, the methodology, the mindset, and the output that you get before you go on a fight with them, telling them, listen, we are not going to do it the way that you think it is, because we need to fundamentally rethink it. So sometimes you need to take a few steps to get there.
Right. And then I guess the big ones also kind of resemble paradigm shifts, right? Like when we think about the whole shift that is maybe happening from a fixed mindset, I learned some things until university and then I only progress in my job, to continuous learning. Or when we think about, I suppose, performance evaluations and growth, where there's a lot of new research happening and books are being published and people are starting to rethink what should that actually be, but they're probably very hard to touch because they're so ingrained.
Exactly. And I think everything is on the table. Pay is a really good one.
Yeah.
Pay is one that I would love to redesign because I think it's kind of unfair. Nobody really knows what's happening. And because of that, everybody's saying they're having a bad deal. And I think it would be really interesting to rethink pay, rethink compensation, rethink, you know, should it be open or not? Should it be transparent or not? Should it be more granular or not? How much differences can you have between people? Should you be upfront about why some people are paid more than others because they help solve bigger challenges? And I think those are the kind of things that we could have a really big impact by relooking at that and realizing that people work also to get paid and to get wealthy. So how can the organization help you and realize that there is a space for helping you with that by paying you, not necessarily more, but helping you manage your money better, for example, which is a really good opportunity. And I think it's those type of things. Okay, let's change the paradigm about pay. Let's be really radical about it. That's hard, but right. Little step can actually get you there. And I think there is a lot of appetite for that.
Yeah. So once you have identified a topic to look at and you get into kind of the project or product mode, does it make any difference to you that here the audience in this case is maybe very well defined, in a way also very captive, versus if you're looking at B2C or even just outside customers, you kind of really have to, I guess, appeal to them. You kind of force them to use it, but in employee experience, you actually kind of can. Does it make any difference to your approach, to the tools you're using, that you have this fixed audience that is completely defined and that kind of has to do what in the end you're working on?
So two things on that. The first thing is about a captive audience. I think having a captive audience is the reason why we have so many bad products internally. And I think we need to change our mind there. And we need to realize that we should aim to create product that people will be ready to pay for. And that's going to change a lot of the quality of the offering that we have. I think today people change job, change organization. So you tend to think of them as captive, but actually they're not exactly captive. They're captive to a certain extent. And stopping looking at them as captive, I think, is fundamental to starting offering better product. The second thing is, when you create a product in an external environment, usually you start by looking at a population, and then you start segmenting it, and then you start looking at, well, we have segmented it, we have found a gap in the market, we have found an opportunity, we want to create a product that targets especially that segment, because we think that that's where we can have a space to shine and make sure that our product is well perceived. The difference when you start talking about employees is that you have a lot smaller target population. You have what, like maybe 30, maybe 100,000, maybe 500,000 maximum employees.
Yep.
Compared to a world population, it's really small. But you can't really segment them. I mean, you can segment them, but you can't really decide I'm only going to target a certain portion of it, because you need to provide those products to everyone. You cannot say we're going to create a really new product for performance management and only give it to a target population, because that's what makes sense. You need to provide that to everyone. And that is what is a very big change in the way you are looking at it, because you need to start looking at almost portfolios of products, because you can't rely on external partner to do it. So you need to start looking at, well, if we segment because we find that people have different behaviors, how might we create different product that can either adapt to different behaviors or be fundamentally different so that everyone gets something for themselves? And I think that's a really important part to realize as well, because we tend to think of, let's have one product that everybody is going to use and be really happy with it. But you realize not everyone is using it the same way. And you should never forget that you have to provide for everyone. So it's almost closer to how would a government create product, because they need to provide product to all of their citizens,
yeah,
more than how an organization would provide product for consumers. And that's also something that's really important to realize.
So does anything differ in terms of the process, the way you do research when you actually go about creating something?
I think our process is fairly close to what I would use in a normal consumer type of environment. We do a lot of desk research to understand conceptually what are we talking about. We do a lot of user research where we run office ethnographies, one-on-one interviews, all type of tools that you will use in a normal design thinking type of environment. We do a lot of designs, we do a lot of testing, we do a lot of prototyping. So it's very similar to what I would use in a normal environment, but I would probably be, again, a little bit less specific, pointy in the output that I'm looking for, because I want to target everyone. Yeah. So I want to have product that can be flexible to target everyone, or have more than one product that is being launched at the same time.
To ensure that you cover basically the whole audience, either with one or with a couple of products, but you need to have full coverage that
exactly.
Everybody has access.
Exactly.
Right. Then, I mean, generally, we're talking a lot nowadays about the business value of design. This is a topic I think that really came up 2017. And last year, McKinsey released a big study about the business value and ROI of design and how important it is, and how actually design-driven organizations generate better returns. Mm-hmm. With internal experiences, how do you think about measuring the impact of the products and the experience that you create? Is there any metrics that you have found that makes sense?
Not yet. We're still looking at that. And that's one of my highest priority, because I really believe that if you can't measure the output of what you are doing, you kind of have a 3-year timeline before your team shut down. And I think that the measurement might be at a project level. So at the beginning of every project, we should define how it is that we want to measure the output. But the bottom line is everything should be having a monetary impact in the organization. In the end, it is about getting people more productive. It is about getting people to do better, to do their best work, regardless what it is that you are providing them. And I think you should find a way to always attach it back to the bottom line of the organization.
Yeah.
The tricky part is how. Sometimes it's a bit pulling hair. Sometimes it's a bit weird. We save that many hours. If we're looking at the average salary per hour, this is how much we are gaining. The reality is, it's not that straightforward. You know, it's not because you save 1 hour that you're going to be 1 hour more productive. But you should assume that taking away frustration, taking away time spent into doing something, should result in a higher productivity. So for me, it always should go down to how do we get people to do their best work, and how do you help people to be more productive?
Yeah. And at the same time, I suppose not every initiative can have exactly the same measurements, right? And whatever you do measure kind of also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because exactly. At some point, since we have product mindset, so that means we put a team in charge of keeping on developing it, the measurements are put in place, and then that team tries to optimize. Maybe a couple of things have not been considered, not been thought of. Now this is the holy grail. They try to optimize that number, and actually usually numbers are proxies, right? They might lose sight of the actual purpose of what it was supposed to be and just look at this number to make it go up or down, because that's their incentive. How can we avoid that? Is there any way in a good design or product process to kind of ensure that down the road this does not happen? Because that is kind of also, I guess, some of the things that are leading to what we see today with Facebook and Google and all the problematic headlines. How can we avoid just zeroing in on this one metric that once made sense and made sure that the bigger purpose is still always in the mind of the people?
So you get what you measure. So as you said, if you measure one thing, that's exactly what you are going to get. So I like to look at it from a framework of measurements, more than one measure. So every project that we do, I try to look at how do we build that framework so that we can drive the right behaviors and measure it by more than one way? Because if you measure it by only one way, that's the only thing that you're going to get.
Right.
The other thing is you have to look at it sometimes from a long-term perspective. And you have to look at, well, what do we measure in the short term versus what do we measure on the long term? Looking at training is a really interesting example. You can look at training, you can look at training hours, but in the end, what really matters in terms of training is how many people change job into careers that are more relevant for the future, for the organization, for the trends that are happening. But that's 3 years away. Yeah. So again, how do you build those frameworks so that you can have short-term measurement and long-term measurements, and realizing that at the beginning, you're not going to have those, but you still need to take them in account so that you don't fall back into the short-term only.
And you have to plan that from the beginning to put in the right metrics so that in the long term, you actually can close that feedback loop that in the short term is not there yet. Huh?
So I think you should, but also think that that should be flexible. And then you go back into the product mindset and the life cycle of product. So that's why you need to have people that are constantly looking at those to realize, well, maybe we made a mistake thinking that people should change career and have more digital careers, for example, because it doesn't matter that as much as we thought it did. And then you can reevaluate it.
Yeah. Is there any way to ensure this kind of mindset or transition these considerations in big organizations where people also change jobs quite a lot, right? Every 2, 3, 4 years, you might move on to a different role or to a different company. Somebody new comes in who was not part of the inception of the product, who might have no idea of all of these considerations of what it was supposed to do. How can we kind of hand that over to ensure that it doesn't get lost in transitions?
I guess we should, again, do the same way that product organizations do it. If you're working at Spotify and one of your product managers that is working on the recommendation aspect of the product is leaving, is going to be replaced by someone else who kind of need to follow the same strategy.
Right.
So I'm hoping that you would have product strategy related to that particular domain and that someone taking it over can change it because things move and should be adapted, but should not start from scratch and should still retain some of the institutional knowledge.
Yeah. So as you mentioned earlier, I mean, you're part of a large organization now, and at some point, if not already, but some point down the road, you'll have to justify the value of what you're doing, right? You said if you don't have any numbers 3 years down the road, your team will probably not exist anymore. In the lack of dollar figures, is there anything else that you think can communicate the value of good employee experience and of what you're working on?
So the way I'm saying the value we're providing is twofold. On one, we are doing our job and we're doing developing, designing better experiences for people. And that's one thing you have to measure. On the second hand, we are changing the organization itself. So on that side, it's around, well, how much did we change the HR department into being more user-centric, into understanding design technique, into understanding design thinking, into running workshops, into teaching them? And I think the value that we bring is on those two sides. So that's why we have to measure both sides.
Yeah. How do you think about change management, especially if you look at existing organizations that are decades, if not centuries old? There's a certain way of doing things that might be from the last couple of decades, or it might even be older because it never was challenged enough to be changed. And now maybe you're looking at things and say, okay, here is a medium to big kind of topic that we need to rethink. And obviously there will be a certain resistance. Organizations kind of have these antibodies that happen to pop up whenever you want to change something a bit more structurally, because they're kind of built in a protect kind of manner that they want to sustain themselves the way they are. So I guess change management is probably also quite a topic that must be on your radar, whether you're directly responsible or not for rolling out these products. How do you think about that in the context of employee experience? Is there quite a big pushback when you change things, or are people actually happy and they say, hey, we have been stuck in this old paradigm, now somebody new is coming and it's actually well designed, that's great, I'll adopt it? How's the reaction to what you do?
So I find that you need to do change management at the corporate level, teaching people about what it is that you do so that they understand. And for us, it's at HR level and making sure that everybody understands that. You need to do change management at employee level. Surprisingly, I find that in my current organization, this is actually okay because people are very keen for change. And then you need to do change management at people manager level. And sometimes that's the harder one to do. So we have a team in charge of that, that have set up a really interesting model of having change agents in different countries to help bring those ideas, to monitor how much people are using new systems and a new concept, and to do trainings, to convince them, to do roadshow, to do all of those things. I think that's actually working pretty well. Because as soon as you start getting global, you need to start looking at basically all your go-to-market activities. And you need to have people on the ground for that. I think it's very, very difficult to do at a global level. But that's why we have a team that is dedicated to that.
So when you have to change, for example, the mindset of somebody who manages people, because now there's new paradigms, new ways of doing that, and you encounter a bit of resistance, is there any kind of proven method, intervention, ever it might be, that you feel, okay, this is how we can actually get them on board? Or is it very specific in every case?
So we have two issues there. One is a certain resistance to change because people have been through too much. And the second one is different cultural model. So on the first one, it was really interesting because we did some ethnographies a while ago and we ended up with people telling us they wouldn't use a new career development tool because, yeah, it looks great. I'm sure it's great. But you know what? I've done it before and I just don't have time because last time I did it, nothing happened. So for those things, what we're looking at is how do we sell success stories? How do we prove that it is useful, that it is valuable for them? How do we prove that if there is a new career management system, that everybody that have changed career have been found using that system so that people can truly believe that it is worth the effort? Because nobody have time, right? Nobody have focus. So everybody's struggling with that. The second part is a cultural aspect of it.
Yeah.
And that's about realizing that in some market, being a line manager means people work for you. You can manage your career on your own time, at home, at night. That's it. When you are in here, you work for me and you do whatever I told you. So again, at global level, we're like, oh, let's have those experiences where people can control their career, and it's just not going to fly. So we're still exploring what to do with that. Some of the ideas we're looking at is how do we get countries to compete?
Yep.
How do we sell again success stories showing that country A have used that and everybody benefited from it? The employees benefited from it, the line managers benefited from it, the bottom line of the business benefited from it. And country B refuse it because of cultural ideas, and maybe they need to relook at that. So at the moment, that's what we're testing. I'm not sure if it's going to work yet.
That's a very interesting point also, because you're working in a global organization, and the different organizations across the geographies are not only different in terms of how developed they are and what different concepts like health and so forth might mean, but also a lot of cultural notions, right, between the Western world, between Asia, and then more granularly the different countries. How big of a difference in some of the projects you have approached did that make, or can that come somehow be squared away and we say, okay, there are differences, but if we just design it in the right way, they can still be squared away in the same product?
It depends. The difference can be massive. We did some research a while ago on providing HR services and what human meant to HR services, what being human meant in there. And I will talk to someone in New York who will tell me, listen, for me, being human is all about helping me. It's all about understanding what my problem is. So I receive a form and I love it because I know exactly what question is asked to me. I can exactly answer it. And I know the person on the other side have everything that they need to help me and to help to solve my problem. And in the same conversation, I will talk to someone who is in Nigeria and will tell me, listen, human is about personal relationship. So I want to talk to someone. They need to know my children. They need to know the name of my children. We need to have a casual chat before anything happens.
Yeah.
And that's what human means. So the same concept can be really, really different. We saw that in feedback as well. When we did some research on how do people give feedback to each other. And we talked to people in London where feedback is fairly straightforward. You have something to say to someone, whoever that is, you say it. And we talked to someone in India where we asked him, what if your manager asks you for constructive feedback for her? And he couldn't even understand the question because it was so inconceivable that your manager would ask you for constructive feedback. Right. He asked us to repeat the question 3 times and refused to answer and say, I'll come back to you later. So it's really interesting how those cultural differences are massive and you never really know where they come from. It can be geographic differences. It can be size of office differences. When you live in a place where you're in a regional headquarters with 10,000 people, it's very different than when you're in an office with 40 people.
Yeah.
It can be the environment that is different. Everything can have a role to play. So we never really know where those creep in, but we always find a lot of them. And we need to find a way to solve them.
So while we usually depict large global organizations as kind of standardized and sometimes even faceless, actually they need to have a lot of empathy in order to be that global and retain a global workforce.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty is to realize at what point do you accept those differences and at what point you don't. So you need to respect some of those differences, and some of them are exactly what is going to give the richness to your organization. Some of them you don't want to accept them because you have really negative behaviors that are tolerable in some countries, but that as an organization you should not accept. And that's a difficulty about where do you draw the line and where do you try to change them versus where do you embrace them.
So thinking about that and then also about the goal of what you want to achieve when you look at this big journey, is there any vision, any kind of compass, any base values driving then also some of these difficult decisions?
Overall, what I want to do is I want to empower people to do their best work. That's what it is. Looking at some of those cultural differences, it's going to be around sometime helping people to understand themselves better so they can understand how they are in a global environment. Sometimes it's about understanding those differences better so that we can adapt them. And it's a part of the process more than anything.
So maybe zooming out then a bit from the look at employee experience and how that maybe then also reflects on the organization from the outside. Do you see any connections between organizations that provide a great employee experience and that provide a great customer experience, or are these topics rather disconnected?
I think it's very connected, because better employee experience mean people do better work, mean they are going to create better product and are going to serve their employees better. So for me, everything is connected. Also, I think that an organization that deeply understands one or the other is capable of delivering one or the other. So if you are in an organization where employee centricity is really strong, it's going to be a lot easier for people delivering services to customer to understand why customer centricity is really, really important, and vice versa as well.
Do you feel that any of the two topics is more important, or they should be kind of seen as equal?
I think it depends where you work. You always have the feeling of being the center of the attention. So I think if you work in employee experience, you're going to feel this is more important. If you work in customer experience, you're going to feel that this is more important. I think both of them are. I think both of them need to be mindfully connected. They don't need to be the same. When you create product internally, you have a chance to have a different personality to your product. If you work on some things like bank, insurances, energy, those kind of big meaty topics, Usually you try to have a fairly honest, like, trustable type of brand. When you are internal, you can be a bit more fun as well. So you can, even if you are a really big organization that is all about delivering flawlessly some product, you can still be a bit fun internally. And I think it's around realizing the differences between those two aspects so that you can mindfully connect them, but still control them independently. So it's not because you have a fun organization that your product needs to be fun. It's not because you have a very serious product that your organization needs to be very serious. I think you can move in between a bit.
And then in between, actually, those two areas of customer experience and employee experience is kind of also something in between, which is a bit about partners or people that you rely on, be it people that you work with in terms of an outsourcing fashion, or now maybe more and more freelancers, part-timers in the gig economy. We're looking at people who on demand make their work available. Is this kind of experience also part of the employee experience? Is that a different field? Are we already looking at that? What does that look like?
So I think that the future of work is very flexible. What I really like when I'm looking at the future of work is that a legal department might hire a designer to help them to redesign some of their output. And that's great. And I love it, because
I would love that.
Yes, yes. I have a few clients that I really want them to do that, by the way. Yeah. But so I really like that, because I think it's about being less formal, and it's about realizing that sometimes you need skills that are beyond what your department is providing. And that notion of being able to bring them in is really important. The problem that happens when something like that happens is usually those designers end up in a department where nobody really understands what they do. So they provide a service, but that's it. Yeah. And then there is no career management, because they're never going to take over their boss role, because it's a legal department. The manager will never be able to give them advice on how to do their craft better. They will never be able to give them advice on their career and how to manage that career. And what we are starting to look at is, so what? Should we have some guild? Should we have some group of craftsman. You talked about craftsman before,
yeah.
So that people can be connected. Should you have a chief project management officer somewhere that is overlooking all project managers that are scattered in the organization to help them to increase their capabilities, their craft, their skills, to think about where to move next, to have career discussion, coaching discussion, all those type of things. And I think this is actually part of employee experience, because again, when you look at a very high level of an archetype of those experiences, you have people that are in a career track and people that are in a track of providing almost entrepreneurial services.
Yeah.
And again, we need to target both, because we need to help both. Because if you help only one of them, the other one is not going to provide his best work for your organization. And I think it's a shame, and you're losing a lot there.
Absolutely. When I see when I look at the role of design and the topics that designers now have impact on, we're all talking about journeys, about experiences. I mean, we've come a long way. Right? Mm-hmm. The last one or two decades, design has really gained a seat at many tables. Are we at peak design yet, or is there still a lot of frontiers where we actually need to push towards?
I don't think there is such a thing as peak frontier. I think it's about involvement. Design used to be, I don't know, I think initially design was very about manufacturing. Then it got into more graphic. Then it got into a lot of iteration. Then you started talking about design thinking. Now you start talking more and more about business design. And I think it's around realizing that design is a mindset that you can apply in everything. And that's what I tend to tell my team as well, which is you're a UX designer in an organization that I have a few UX designers, but that's kind of it. The big question is, how do you develop your craft? How do you develop your career? Where do you go next? And realizing that designing is about solving problems. And there's a lot of jobs that are about solving problems that are not called a designer.
Right.
And I think more and more we are going to see that. We are going to see designers moving into roles that are not primarily design, but that are something else, which is problem solving. And that's why I don't think there's really a limit. I think it's more an evolution. I think we're moving more and more into the business. We are moving more and more into the management side of things. And that's really good, because we designers tend to try to bring a very user-centric, empathetic view of the world. And that's great.
Yeah. So many organizations, as they think about their digital transformation and pushing more for innovation and so forth, they're also embracing this. And they also see that there's a lot of value, of course, also publicized in the different studies and so forth. They look into hire designers, sometimes for the first time in their complete history. They have never had any designers in-house. How can they think about, okay, how do I get started? What are the first hires that I might need to make? And what are some of the mistakes that I need to avoid when I build up this team of people that have a very different mindset than I've never had in my organization before? Mm.
I think what is difficult for organizations that hire designers for the first time is that they tend to see them as someone who is providing a very specific skill. And the reality is you need to think about it from a career perspective. You need to think about it about how you're going to integrate them, how they're going to really be part of the organization from a career perspective, from the type of project they're going to be working on, from the type of delivery they're going to have. The No. first thing that you think of delivering is a design, whatever that means in the organization that you're in. And then you realize that really quickly, what is valuable with those teams is the way they think,
yeah.
the way they approach problem, the way they bring another type of methodology to solutions. And that's something that you need to keep in mind and find a way to use, because it's good for you and it's good for them as well.
And it was a very sought after skill set. Many people are looking to hire designers now. It's a very small market, actually, especially when we look at Singapore or Asia in general. And from our point of view, design is kind of an apprenticeship craft. Young designers want to work with experienced designers because you want to learn from them. It's not so much about hard facts, but it's about the craft, the process. And if you don't have anybody on that level, how can organizations attract young, talented designers if they don't yet have a culture in place that might appeal to them?
Well, I guess one way would be to hire a senior one first, who can then set up all of that. I think another way would be to rely a bit on the community. A place like Singapore is amazing because there is a massive design community where people rely on each other for exchanges, for discussion, for all of that. And maybe if you can't provide that internally, you need to realize that it needs to be provided externally and you need to encourage it. A lot of the organizations tend to think about the employees coming in and secrecy, you cannot talk about what you do, that are all those things. Mm. But you need to realize that it's a good way to get them to connect with the external world as well. And I think you can do that in a few ways. One way is you are very open and you push for them to be part of conferences, community, all of those type of things. You could even push that by saying, hey, why don't we do some kind of secondment, even across organizations. The other way that I tend to look at it, even for bigger places, is how do we bring consultancy? How do we bring consultancy to bring a bit of fresh blood as well? Because designers who work in organization often get stuck into always the same problem and don't necessarily move their craft as much as they would like to. And sometimes it's about realizing that having a consultancy that come over is good for doing project, but it's good for collaboration as well. And I think that's actually a really interesting model because you have new way of thinking, you have new relationship that you build between your team and another one, and you get really good result with that.
And then another thing that we often see, especially if organizations haven't really engaged in that whole topic for quite a while, is design is very much user-centric and therefore talking to people, researching, testing. Many organizations can be a bit squeamish, especially in the B2B space when it comes to, oh, you want to not talk to my customers? What do you want to discuss with them? Just talk to the sales guy. He knows the customer. Don't talk to the customer. How can we kind of take that fear away that, you know, there's going to be any relationship hurt and actually get them more into a mindset of, hey, we're co-creating something here. Your customer should be very happy about that. Why don't you let us run small experiments and then sit in and then, you know, see what happens?
If you're not ready to get someone talking to your customer, you're just lying to yourself. That's it. You should always be ready to hear what they have to say. Because if there is something negative to say, it's fantastic. It means you need to improve. If they only have good things to say, well, it's good as well. And if you think they're going to be offended because you are asking them, again, I think you're on a wrong path and you're maybe not ready for even hiring a design team. Customer centricity or consumer centricity or employee centricity, basically end user centricity is fundamental to doing anything. And that's it. You just need to have it.
You just need to have it. That's a good wrap, Olivier. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Good luck for everything.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost in Transformation with our host Sebastian from Ming Labs. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe to our channel and leave us a review on iTunes. Join us next time for another episode of our podcast.